Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags, and over the next 30 minutes, I'll bring you the latest headlines from South Africa and around the globe. Whether you're tuning in live or catching the podcast later, please stay with us for in-depth conversation with leading business minds, political influencers, and key newsmakers. It is everything you need to stay informed, quick, sharp, and straight to the point. It's Wednesday, the 16th of October. Coming up, the Minister of Public Works announces a new plan to turbocharge infrastructure investment. With DSTV results showing a decline in subscribers, we'll ask if this bodes the end for pay TV. Shock reaction as Parliament orders health checks for staff, and why South African companies are spending exorbitant amounts of money on cyber security. All right, let's start with this. The Minister of Public Works and Infrastructure, Dean McPherson, has unveiled a project preparation bid window aimed at accelerating infrastructure investment and driving economic growth. The initiative invites both public and private sectors to submit proposals for project preparation, support, and particularly for large-scale infrastructure projects with a value of over R1 billion. With priority sectors like energy, water, and transport, the bid window, I'm told, aims to get more shovel-ready projects off the ground, bringing jobs and much-needed economic stimulation. The Minister joins us on the program now. Welcome, and first of all then, Minister, can you outline the main objectives? What's the end goal here?
Well, what we're trying to do, Jeremy, is make it easier for government entities, for provincial governments and local municipalities, also in conjunction with the private sector, to be able to be ready to go as quickly as possible with financing of infrastructure projects. What we have done is an analysis over the last while is to understand why projects fail to get off the ground. And the reality is that many of them, and a lot of them, quite frankly, don't get off the ground because they are ill-prepared. They are unable to get financing in open capital markets because of the lack of preparation that takes place. So in order to mitigate that problem, what we've done is we sought funding from National Treasury to create a project preparation facility within Infrastructure South Africa, whereby entities or arms of the state can approach us and say, we have a project that is worth more than R1 billion. It is catalytic in nature and job intensive. And we will effectively fund and do the preparation on your behalf. So that is just a massive new opportunity that has never been done, so that we are then able to also work with you to then go and access financing and funding. Because, Jeremy, many of these entities, or particularly local government, just aren't able to access private sector capital because they have bad credit ratings and they're unable to complete jobs. So we think that this is, as I've said, it will turbocharge infrastructure development because we are going to support those projects at their inception and not on their commencement.
Minister, let me get a little bit more granular here. Are you able to elaborate on the sectors that you're prioritizing and the criteria that the projects will need to meet to qualify for preparation support?
Yes. So the sectors that we're really honing in on are those that are crucial to our economy. That is water and sanitation. We know that we have a looming problem in that area. One just has to look at parts of Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal, where water has really, really damaged the economy there. So we want to focus in on that, particularly in bulk water infrastructure in local government. I think that is ripe for assistance from us, and we will be able to also source funding for that from the private sector. We're also looking at particularly efficiencies within port and rail, as well as in transport, and then in transmission. So we're not saying we can do everything. We only have 600 million rand over the next 3 years, but we're really using this as sort of a sandbox exercise. We want to see what the feedback is, what the participation is. I think we're going to be oversubscribed in this round. And then if it works, we're then going to be able to expand it further into other sectors of government and the economy.
What type of risk assessment framework are you developing or have developed to ensure that these projects are feasible and sustainable? It's all very well to take the project to the line, but you've got to make sure that there's a long tail here, that you're actually monitoring progress to make sure that it doesn't fall off the tracks.
Absolutely. And I think that that's why the initiative that we have announced is a de-risking measure for infrastructure projects. Because what we've seen, particularly in local government, is that National Treasury allocates 950 billion rand over the medium-term framework over 3 years for infrastructure development. And I would argue that the results of that are indifferent at best. We have local municipalities that return infrastructure grants. So this is actually a risk mitigation measure. We, of course, have actuaries, we have engineers, we have project planners that actually look at the project and say, what is the financial viability? So projects have to be financially viable if we want to get private sector investment. And the most opportune infrastructure projects are where there are tariffs related to that. So water, roads and transmission, energy, where there is risk that government has to carry, and we will assess what that risk is. And if needs be, we will then put an additional funding to de-risk those projects. So water is a really good example on that. So water obviously is a fundamental human right. So government will then put in an allocation, which is effectively an indigent grant, to de-risk that and then allow the private sector to fund the profitable side of that project. So when we have unpacked that with various financial institutions that we've been meeting with, they are very receptive to that idea. So the de-risking takes place on two measures, to summarize: one, financially, and two, through the professional services that we offer through Infrastructure South Africa.
Now, let me try and connect what you're doing to an existing problem. It's all very well to start the process and cut the red tape and make sure that the application process is well managed. But once you actually start the build, you've then, Minister, got the construction mafia, which is causing a huge problem in South Africa. That could be a wrinkle. But you've now said that there is the possibility of calling in the SANDF.
Well, I didn't say that. What I said is that it was used to great effect by Eskom when they were under attack and internal sabotage, and the SANDF was deployed by the president, and was the correct thing that he did in that instance to secure those sites to stop them from being attacked. Now, I've said that if that's been done previously, maybe we should be looking at whether that model can work, particularly around big, high-value infrastructure projects. But that is just, you know, it's one problem. The other problem that we have to deal with, Jeremy, is the incentivization of that behavior. And that has come through the so-called 30% set-aside rule through procurement, which has effectively monetized criminal behavior, acts of violence, and murder to the detriment actually of construction companies that are emerging and want to participate in government projects. They are the ones who have said, well, this may have been a good intention to begin with. Its application has been disastrous for our businesses because we have lost people, we are chased off of sites, and our work doesn't exist. So I think that we've got to look at this in two ways. One, we've got to secure those sites, critically important. Two, we've got to look at how do we include participation in emerging players in the sector without creating financial incentives for well-organized criminal syndicates to bring these projects to a halt.
Are you prepared to make a call for the deployment of the military at this point?
Well, that's not my call. That constitutionally can only be done by the president. Those are discussions that we can have, but I publicly will not do so because that is not my remit. But I am working closely with the National Police Minister to look at ways of how we can resolve this and how we can deploy more police officers potentially to secure sites. But we also have to involve the private sector and private security. They are have vast resources that we can tap into. And on the 19th of November, I will be hosting a national construction site summit in Etegweni, which KZN has obviously really been ground zero, so to speak, of this sort of behavior. And we will be inviting various ministers, MECs from across the country, and industry players to hammer out a solution that we can all commonly agree on and then implement with determination.
The Minister of Public Works and Infrastructure, Dean McPherson, thank you very much for joining me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
All right, let's move from public works to pay TV. And MultiChoice has shown a significant decrease in active DSTV subscribers, dropping from 8 million to 7.6 over the past 12 months or so. Alarmingly, all segments of MultiChoice's DSTV subscriber base have declined. DSTV premium 8% year on year, the mid-market by 9%, and the mass market by 1% year on year. Leslie Adams is sales director at streaming expert Reach Africa and says that streaming has grown in direct proportion to the expansion of internet services and I guess the deepening cost of living crisis. So he joins me on the program now. And first of all, then, what do these subscriber numbers tell us, Leslie, about the current state of the pay TV market in the country?
It actually tells us a lot around the sense that I think South Africans aren't as far behind the technological curve as we think we are. Globally, we've seen pay TV channels decline by over 50%. And in fact, it's happening a lot slower in South Africa, but still following the same trend. The ultimate fact is that streaming, and paid streaming and free streaming, is ultimately coming after the audience base and providing a service very similar to what they do without a paywall in many cases, or sometimes much cheaper.
So if the current trajectory continues, is pay TV heading for the grave?
It's always premature to say we're heading for the grave. I mean, you've said things like that around cinema. Cinema's been dying since 1970. Television will always have a place and a form for all South Africans and for all viewers out there. What television will look like at the end of the day will change and evolve dramatically. So in the very early days, all we had was sort of aerial reception. Then we had satellite, or actually before satellite, we had the Mnet decoder. We then moved into satellite television. And I think what's quite interesting about that is that the next evolution of television viewing will effectively be internet-driven. So it will be infused with apps. It will be infused with live television. Sports will move from our traditional pay TVs into the streaming services. So what it means for DSTV is that the glory days of satellite television or pay TV is gone, but the new evolution doesn't necessarily exclude them at all.
But it's also important for pay TV, and particularly an entity like DSTV, is that sport surely remains the jewel in the crown. A crown, lose that and you're in trouble. But the caveat to that is that streaming services are coming after that particular prize.
The fact of the matter is, it's not about an if, but rather when. And I think what's been quite interesting, and I think we actually have to give the MultiChoice team quite credit for, is that they've actually moved sport into the streaming environment with Showmax. The fact of the matter is, globally, we see different sporting codes, especially in the US, move from sort of normal pay television to now include streaming and compete head-to-head with pay TV. What that really means is that crown and the jewel will, in fact, be separated exclusively from pay television to now include streaming and other players. From a sporting code perspective, last year we had an ongoing conversation around should the BOC games be available to all South Africans for free? Well, what's really interesting about that sub-licensing agreement that SABC Plus has put in place with DSTV for different BOC games is that that now includes SABC Plus as well. So sport has gone streaming, it has gone mainstream to a wider audience, and in fact, it now exists without a paywall. So it's not an if question, it's a rather when question. And I think what's going to be quite interesting from a business perspective is how they'll adapt, how the licensing will adapt to protect their business, or at least protect their revenues in that space.
Leslie, I'm glad you raised Showmax. There is the argument that there's not enough of an integrative strategy between DSTV and Showmax. They're seen as very separate entities. Do you agree with that premise, and is there strength or weakness in that argument?
It's really a matter of perspective. I think the fact of the matter is you've got to separate them to allow them to compete independently and, you know, put themselves first within that space. as it stands, if you look at it, the multi-choice pay TV business is a mammoth. It's the revenue driver. It's the everything driver for the business. And if you keep those two businesses together, it'll always be overshadowed by the larger broadcast business. Separating them, I think, in my opinion, allows Showmax to be a digital-first business to compete in that way. But on the behind the scenes, if you look at, they've used a lot of their competitive strengths to benefit Showmax. A lot of their content licensing and their content sort of libraries is shared. What's really interesting about that is that, you know, we see this in cinema quite often where Disney, for example, will have a massive Marvel film same day release as the streaming service, which completely cannibalizes their cinema business. So from a multi-choice integration sort of strategy and how it goes forward, I think the Showmax team has fought hard to be independent and slightly further away from the core business to allow them to compete in a digital-first environment and adapt accordingly. Whereas the broadcast business has to deal with their sort of evolving change and falling revenues from subscribers and what that means for their future landscape. Those two things are completely different priorities, and therefore you need teams functioning and focusing on their independent businesses, in my opinion, within their strength.
Leslie, talking about falling revenues, as far as DStv cord cutting is concerned, do you think it's purely a price play in South Africa, or simply because we have more streaming choice and availability?
So I think it's a multi-layered sort of answer on that one. Increased competition will mean a segmentation of the market and a fracturing of the market, which means, you know, I only have 10 Rand. How far can this 10 Rand go for my content consumption? And from month to month, they may change, right? So we've seen some really interesting trends in the numbers where SABC, when they had AFCON and the Rugby World Cup, we saw a massive spike in their audiences, both on linear and on streaming. We've seen how this multi-layered way of functioning in the space. So I think the challenge that we find, or the opportunity we find, is globally, it must be said, that no streaming service outside of Netflix is profitable. So it does underline the fact that, you know, pay television is still the breadwinner in the sort of ecosystem. But what does it mean for the consumer? The consumer has more choice than they've ever had before. For a long, long time, if you wanted high quality television content, your only option was multi-choice. That is no longer the case, which means increased competition means that you've got to compete both on quality and on price, which I think, at the end of the day, I think multi-choice offers a very valuable solution, but everybody's content needs is different. And that's where I think the consumer and high churn, you know, switching between channels, switching between apps, switching between services, does impact them, where before, because they had no competition, your end of month subscription fee was almost guaranteed, and that is no longer the case.
Just a final one then, is it entirely going forward a content play? In other words, what should traditional pay TV providers like MultiChoice be doing to remain competitive in the face of growing streaming platforms, as you've outlined to me?
So I think they've always had this very interesting sort of a la carte menu from a content perspective, and they've managed for a large part to be everything to every consumer, and that's no longer the case. There's a couple of things that we find sort of key tentpoles, especially in the African market. They have to focus on access, which DStv sort of has led television access through satellite. They now need to evolve that into an internet phase where, you know, content's available anywhere and everywhere. There's a cost factor, a price factor, which means that curating different subscription sizes for different consumers becomes very interesting and very complicated from a licensing perspective. The other thing is the fact that, you know, free still wins. SABC still has the largest audience of all linear television broadcasters. And then free services will compete even more aggressively within that space. So how to evolve their revenue menu per se, and where how they pull revenue from different avenues will be quite interesting. The fact of the matter is, what we're going to see is probably more pain before we see more growth. So the trends we're seeing now of pay TV declining, this is only the beginning. And what it will look like at the end will be quite interesting to see, because ultimately we all have this sort of unending content need as consumers. But at the same time, we also have this limited budget to apply to it. So the one who can sort of meet all of those needs at the best cost, at the most easiest way to access, will obviously win.
Leslie Adams, thank you very much indeed. I do appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Parliament's recent mandate requiring staff to undergo comprehensive health tests, covering everything from urine and blood samples to eyesight checks, is raising concerns. Officials claim it's to comply with the law, but is this requirement legal and how enforceable is it? I'm joined now by Professor Halton Cheadle, Emeritus Professor from UCT's Law Faculty, to discuss the legal framework and these potential enforcement challenges and how the decision ultimately could be contested. So, Professor, first of all, then, is there a specific legal basis that Parliament is using to justify these tests?
No. No. Can I give you a quick outline of the Occupational Health and Safety Act? There are seven areas in which medical surveillance can take place. The one is enlisted works. Enlisted works are works that the minister lists because they are particularly hazardous. And Parliament is just not a listed work. And then there are regulations for hazardous chemical substances, hazardous biological agents, asbestos, lead, noise, and ergonomics. Now, Parliament, as I see from the Sunday Times, relies on regulations for hazardous chemical substances. Now, and yes, it's correct that an employer must ensure that an employee is medically surveyed if exposed to a hazardous chemical agent. But if you look at and it says, it lists them in an annexure, and if one has a look at that annexure, one sees that you have aminophenol, benzidine. These things are, so if you take nitrophenol, for example, it's to manufacture drugs, fungicides, insecticides, and dyes. You know, so it's just short of, and basically they're eight listed, and none of them would occur in the Parliament. The same thing happens to hazardous biological agents. Those agents are the biological agents like COVID and all things that hospitals are particularly prone to. So the hospital would clearly be covered by this, but not Parliament. Right. And as far as asbestos, lead, and noises, that's obvious. The only one that could possibly operate is ergonomics. And that's obviously because people are in offices, so they might require special chairs, and you know, there's also for typhus called carpal tunnel syndrome. But again, what must happen is that you've got to have a risk assessment which identifies the hazards, and then once the hazards are identified, then you can medically survey them, but only on the recommendation of a health, an occupational health practitioner. So, and it's risk specific, so it's got to do with carpal tunnel syndrome,
right,
or backache, you know, and so you can't ask for urine tests and you can't ask for blood pressure. I mean, it's just completely unlawful.
So, Halton, stripping it down then, do you see this directive then as an invasion of privacy, and could it be challenged legally in that respect?
Yes, absolutely. Well, it can be challenged just because it's not authorized under the Occupational Health and Safety Act. Two, it's a clear breach of privacy. It's a breach of the Natural Health Act. Section 14 of that act says, that in relation to medication that you're meant to disclose, you can only do that with the consent of the employee. So the order or instruction to bring your medication in is one, you know, the employees can refuse on the basis of that act.
So how do you see this playing out then, given that Parliament probably doesn't have the authority to enforce this policy? Is it simply an overreach of its powers?
Yes. I mean, I think that obviously it's human resource, the HR department, you know, or occupational health section of it that has done this. And if they just took proper legal opinion, and there's some really very fine lawyers in Parliament, you know, if they got a proper opinion, it would be clear as daylight.
Apart from the invasion of privacy, do you also see this as discriminatory?
Well, it's potentially, isn't it? It's potentially, because you might be identifying people with particular conditions. And again, that raises those kinds of issues. Again, I think what Parliament has said is that they're not going to discriminate, and the like. They're going to, people who have a particular illness, they're going to refer for medical attention. But again, I mean, it seems to me that that's just outside of its powers.
So assuming this continues then, and I'm talking speculatively now, how would enforcement work? I mean, could Parliament legally take action against a staff member who declines to participate in the test?
Well, if it did do that, it would be... So there are different types of sanctions. So let's assume that they discipline them. Well, that would be an unfair labour practice and could be challenged in the labour courts.
Halton, are there precedents or any legal frameworks that South Africa could look to then regarding mandatory workplace health checks, given that some of them, and you did mention at the beginning of our conversation, some of them might be deemed to be important for the employee's own safety?
Yes, no, of course. So I look at we don't need to look at any comparative framework. The framework is in a very good statute, which is the Occupational Health and Safety Act. So it's in those specific instances where there are real hazards like lead, like asbestos, like noise. All of those regulations provide for an employer's obligation for medical surveillance, and clearly it's in the benefit of the employee.
Given that it's going to take some courage for someone to challenge this, how do you see this playing out if that legal challenge doesn't happen? Will it go beyond the courts? How could this be resolved? Because patently, it is, as you mentioned, an issue of invasion of privacy, and it is discriminatory.
Yeah. Well, it has the potential for discrimination. It's an invasion of privacy, certainly in requiring people to produce their prescribed and off-the-counter medicines. that's just not authorised by the Occupational Health and Safety Act. So that if they took action against an employee and dismissed an employee for refusing what they said was a lawful instruction, that employee then obviously could challenge that dismissal in the CCMA, and that would be the one challenge. I mean, I think the unions would be able to bring an interdict in the labour courts to prevent this. So, yes, those would be the ways it would play out.
I'm going to leave it there, and thank you so much for the interpretation and the assessment. Halton Cheadle, appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And finally on the program, cybersecurity attacks are on the rise globally. Well, we all know that, and South Africa, unfortunately, is no exception. With increasing ransomware attacks, data breaches, and privacy concerns, businesses are facing higher costs and more complicated risk. To help us understand the latest trends and how companies can better protect themselves, I'm joined now by Santo Mohopelo, Senior Cyber Underwriter at Allianz Commercial. And first of all then, what are the key factors, and welcome, in your opinion, that are driving the rising costs of cyber insurance claims in this country?
The reasons for the increased costs in South Africa are due to mass ransomware attacks, including data exfiltration, increased regulatory and legal requirements, digital disruptions in the form of supply chain disruptions, business interruption costs, as well as non-attack privacy claims.
Is it about as bad today as it ever has been, or is it getting worse, do you think?
We've seen the ransomware claims stabilizing recently. I mean, if you look at the increase last year was about 73% increase in 2023. However, there's a 15% decrease thus far. The fourth quarter normally is problematic for claims, so we're looking at an increase in claims in the fourth quarter. But due to obviously insurers and companies improving their cyber posture, it is getting better. However, as you know, these the attackers are evolving and creating new ways of attacking these companies.
Yeah, the sense one gets is that they're always one or two steps ahead of us. You talk about an increase in the fourth quarter. What would be behind that?
Traditionally, it's because of the season and the attitude around that time. You find that most companies are closed for business and have a lax attitude in terms of cybersecurity and staff complement restraints around that period.
Santo, does Allianz Commercial have a view on which sectors in South Africa are more vulnerable to these attacks?
Definitely. The sectors that are hard hit are health, financial services, manufacturing, as well as professional services. However, the hardest hit sectors is the SME sector. I think this is due to an attitude in respect of cybersecurity, as well as the budgetary and economic constraints. So we find that a lot of SMEs don't take that seriously or opt not to invest properly.
Yeah, it's a very difficult position that a small enterprise would find itself in, because they would have to spend money to stay protected, but often difficult to find that money. So they've almost got to do a risk assessment, which might weigh on the side of taking a chance.
Yes, definitely. And we've seen that taking a chance has dire consequences. If you follow some of our best practices, you find that you can avoid these consequences by just having simple measures in place.
Let's talk about best practice in just a moment. But should one find themselves the victim of a ransomware attack, how is it investigated by the insurance industry, and how do they go about claiming? What do they need to prove?
Basically, the trigger is the ransomware itself. The company just needs to notify us as an insurer, and then we, the use of our forensics experts, conduct our investigations, help contain the matter, and take it from there.
So you talked about best practice as far as smaller enterprises are concerned. How can businesses then better protect themselves?
Businesses can protect themselves better by A, concentrating on the human element. This is, a simple task of continuous training, simulation of phishing exercises. This definitely reduces the risk considerably. Data classification, as well as having a incident response plan, business continuity plan, and definitely testing these plans accordingly, just like you would with your normal fire drills and so forth. But you would definitely need to interrogate and practice these plans.
It's also quite difficult sometimes, because you also report that weak cybersecurity in supply chains is a major cause of data breach. So often this is something that is in many respects out of your ambit of control.
It is within your ambit of control, because if you look at the supply chain, your vendor and your outsourced service providers, if you have regular audits and manage the risk accordingly, you definitely will have positive results. So looking and managing third-party service providers and OSPs, having regular audits and security checks to see that they're in line with the company's security standards is very important.
And Santo, what about artificial intelligence? It's being viewed as both a threat and a solution to cybersecurity. Explain that to me, and are South African companies incorporating this into their strategies?
Definitely, a lot of the South African companies are incorporating AI into their strategy. The thing about AI is that it also automates and accelerates the attacks, and definitely looks for your weaker points in the system. So it is a vital tool for the attackers. However, it's a positive tool for us on the opposite end, because it helps in terms of notifications, and also in quarantining and also identifying risks rather than doing it manually. So AI definitely assists us in the our assets and our digital assets.
Thank you very much indeed for joining me. That is Santo Mohopelo, Senior Cyber Underwriter at Allianz Commercial. On our last online poll, I asked if the coalition government, or the GNU cabinet rather, was too bloated, and 55% of our respondents saying very, just 2% saying the right size, and 43% saying it could lose a few pounds. Today, and in relation to one of our earlier stories, multi-choice under increasing churn pressure, my question to you today, I'm going, I've gone, or sport and news still does it for me? If you have a view on that, please share it with me, either on X or LinkedIn. That is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.